You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, May 4th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from New York Magazine, David Wallace Wells. On the Corona timeline, in an age of failed leadership. Meanwhile, phase four relief mired in a liability fight, White House is blocking Fauci from testifying to Congress. That's weird. Meanwhile, 7% of mortgage payers have chosen forbearance. And surprise, Georgia reopening, killing people, but not attracting business. Meanwhile, the Mississippi governor reverses an opening after record deaths peaks on that same day. Tara Reid accusation still being debated, but the latest Biden accusation debunked moments after it's made. Trump fires his Health and Human Services Inspector General, who had the audacity of reporting hospital equipment shortages. Dems and Republicans on the antitrust committee call for Jeff Bezos to testify after they were lied to by an Amazon lawyer. And meanwhile, apparently there is, or rather was, one honest person in the Amazon C-suite. And lastly, just like that, Canada bans assault-style weapons. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Hope your weekend was okay and safe, and that you didn't come across too many of those jerks who refuse to wear their masks when they are out in public. Super easy to do. I just saw a stat that if 80% of the people wore even just cloth masks, which is about 60% effective, right? N95 is 95% effective. Cloth mask, 60% effective. If 80% of people did that, then the RO, I think it is the RO, is that what we call it now? I don't know. The we'll ask David Wells, or Wallace Wells. He'll know. But the communicability of the disease goes below one. So in other words, every person who has it will give it to less than one person, and then things would wrap up rather quickly. If 80% of the people wore masks that were 60% effective, that's what it would take. Apparently, that's a math problem. But it's also a, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for? Can I say douchebag problem? I feel like it's a douchebag problem. I mean, I think there's an equal amount of ignorance and an equal amount of just actualized ignorance. People who just like bathe in their ignorance. But hopefully people will smarten up a little bit more. I doubt it. We've got a lot to get to today. Let's do this clip. You know, one of the things that we one of the stories that we have here, really, with this is that, one, the virus is what the virus is. There was always a certain inevitability that this was going to be difficult. America is a tricky place. in many respects because it's less cohesive of a country than many other countries. And to the extent that it's equally as incohesive as other countries, our government has less authority, or we all choose to have our government to have less authority. Fortunately, we have the right to choose that, to enforce cohesion, as it were. But one thing that is that could have mitigated this whole problem that we're having now is if the administration had taken this seriously. If they had taken it seriously starting 2 years ago, and it's not just this administration, it's the whole Republican Party. Their whole perspective on things like public health is an anathema to them because they hate the idea that we as a body politic, as one body politic, as a public, as a government, as a society, can actually influence things in such a way that it benefits everybody. It is contrary to their ideology. So when they see someone sitting on the National Security Council who's in charge of coordinating pandemic response, and there's no pandemic, they say, this is a waste, and so on and so on. And then when we are hit by a pandemic, the only thing they think is like, well, let's bet that this thing blows over. I mean, this is the model that the administration used is like one where we see, you know, a corporation saying, okay, we're dumping this stuff into the water. We know it causes cancer, but we're making billions of dollars a year profit. So let's just keep doing it. And, you know, if we get caught, which is not a guarantee, then we just pay it off. That's the cost of doing business. That's what was going on at the beginning of the of this whole thing. Here is Larry Kudlow. He is on with Jake Tapper. As late as late February, remember, we all went basically in the New York area. We went basically underground, as it were, in mid-March. And here's Larry Kudlow back in, on with Jake Tapper this weekend, but trying to defend what he was saying in February, late February.
Apparently got in the doghouse for saying in a conference call, doghouse with President Trump, for saying in a conference call that it was not a matter of if, but when there would be a severe disruption to the American people and our way to live life. And that's the same day, as you know, that you said this. Let's roll that tape.
We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight. We've done a good job in the United States.
So I guess the question is there a disconnect between what people such as you who want things to be better than they are so as to help the economy are saying and what people in the health field are saying?
Well, look, Jake, for the umpteenth time, I will say my quote then was based on the actual facts, which at the time there were only 40 or 50 cases, and it was contained, particularly after President Trump boldly put up travel restrictions with China. That's what the data. I didn't make a forecast so far, and that was just there was hardly any cases. Okay, now yes, some doctors were more fearful. Other doctors had many different things to say. I don't want to get in and play this game. Who said what and when? Political leaders. One well-known political leader in the House went to Chinatown in San Francisco and said everything is okay. Okay. One important anchor on your network, as late as mid-March, said basically the COVID-19 virus was no worse than an ordinary flu year. I mean, there are people saying my quote was at that time there were very few cases. Ben, as the virus spread exponentially in ways that virtually no one could have predicted, of course, we changed our mind. Going forward, the president and the vice president have taken strong measures, step by step by step, okay? Strong measures to deal with this unexpected outbreak. And I think, you know, the sort of ankle biting that's going on in Washington is just incorrect. You have to deal with the information at hand. When the information changes, you change. We changed our strategy. So did everybody else around.
Wow. That, incidentally, was at like 9 a.m. in the morning. in many respects, we're all Larry Kudlow now. I think probably the you know, liquor sales are through the roof, as it were. But Jesus. The word contained, Matt, you're the host of Literary Hangover. Maybe this is appropriate for me to ask you.
Okay.
When you say contained, what you're saying is that it can't get out, right? I mean, it's not, you're not saying our numbers are low right now. You're saying we've actually put it into a container, if you will.
Sort of confined within something.
Confined. We've confined it. In other words, we've stopped its spread. And Larry wants us to believe that, well, the reason why he said that was because this was before it spread so much. And I think he doesn't understand what the word contained means. But I think he does, and I think he's lying.
Yeah.
They blew this. They made a bet that they could get away. That somehow this wouldn't, that wasn't serious. That the American public wouldn't care, or whatever it is. Just an abject failure. And so I understand why Kudlow is in a position that he would be slurring so significantly that time in the morning on a Saturday, or really any day. I guess it was Sunday. But no, they didn't contain it. And no, and worse than that, they have been promoting these protests to push governors to open up early. And I think we're going to see we're going to pay the price of that. It's now early May. I think we're not going to know till mid-June just how much of a price we're about to pay as a country in terms of the American people. But we will find out soon. Meanwhile, as you know, folks, times are a little tough. Harry's still there to help you look your best while saving you a little cash along the way. Harry's has your grooming needs covered, and listeners can get a Harry's trial set delivered to their doorstep by going to harrys.com/majority report. Harry's is a return to the essential. Quality, durable blades at a fair price with blades as low as $2 each. Delivered straight to your doorstep. Harry's has a 100% quality guarantee. If you don't love your shave, they give you a full refund. Plus, 1% of the proceeds set aside for nonprofit healthcare-oriented organizations. And to help support those who need it most right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. I'm not going to lie to you, folks. I've been using it just... It's been a while since I put my Harry's blade to test. As you can see, I have my coronavirus beard, if you're watching this. However, right here and here, right on my cheeks, I have been using Harry's. Very effective there. But I'm also contemplating getting rid of all of it. Like, I'm just thinking, like, full body shave. That's where I'm... And if I do, I will be doing it with my Harry's razor. Because in part because of its weighted handle, and of course its more narrow shave head. Listeners of my show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You're going to get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip. You're going to get a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade. Rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/majority report to start shaving better today. That's harrys.com/majority report today. Also, a reminder, you're stuck at home. You've watched just about everything in every single queue that you've had. You've binged on all the programs. Well, ExpressVPN protects your privacy and security online, but you can also use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. Now that so many of us are stuck at home, it's only a matter of time until you run out of stuff to watch on Netflix. But you could use ExpressVPN to binge shows like Doctor Who on a UK Netflix. You can just fire up the ExpressVPN app, change your location to the UK, refresh Netflix, and bingo bango, that's it. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries you can go through. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. ExpressVPN is ridiculously fast, so you can stream in HD. It's compatible with all your favorite devices. If you visit expressvpn.com/majority, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself with ExpressVPN. That's expressvpn.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to David Wallace Wells on where we are on this corona timeline and more. Be back in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program David Wallace Wells, deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine, author of The Uninhabitable Earth. David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
I think we've had you on a couple of times to discuss climate change, and universally after every time that you've been on my program, I hear from a lot of people that they are terrified. And I tell them, well, good on some level, because we should be a little bit concerned in terms of, and I'm being understating, obviously, about climate change going forward. And of course, apparently you're also on the, I mean, well, let's start with this, because you're not just on the, near apocalypse beat, I guess. But there is a relationship on some level, or at least possibly, between a pandemic like this and climate change.
Well, there are huge similarities and echoes, which is, I think, why I found myself so, so driven to write about COVID. I've been doing it now, a few times a week for the last few months. And we can talk about those in a second. But yeah, it's also the case that climate change is going to make pandemics like this more common. And that's because what we're doing to the world generally is destabilizing ecosystems and natural habitats. We're doing that through, deforestation and development, but we're also doing it through, turning up the temperature of the planet and making what had been stable local climates much less stable. And what that does is it scrambles the all of the natural lives that are living in those areas. And that means that in some cases, humans are coming into contact with more animals, but it also means that viruses and bacteria are now living in different climate conditions than they evolved to. And they, as a result, may change their behavior, some in some quite dramatic ways that could make them much more dangerous pathogens to the planet as a whole. So this pandemic in particular, we think we know it probably came from, some bats in southern China, passed through some, wet markets or whatever, and came through to Wuhan. There's some possibility it may have escaped from a lab doing research into viruses. But in either case, I don't think you can say that climate change caused this disease, but nevertheless, we're likely to see many more disruptions like this going forward, the more that we disrupt the ecology of the planet. But what interests me more than that storyline is the way that, a lot of people have said things like this is, what we're seeing now is climate change on fast forward, that we're seeing so much that we took for granted as stable and permanent features of modern life transformed rapidly before our eyes, both, in some horrifying ways, and also in some kind of encouraging ways, because the political paths forward that have been opened up are kind of much more radical than would have seemed possible just a few months ago. And if, like climate change, the faster we had taken action to sort of choke this off at the start, the better off the world will be. I think there are a lot of lessons like that to learn from this pandemic going forward. Although on the other hand, I also worry that, by the time we're through this crisis, we're going to be so exhausted emotionally, politically, and, in terms of literal capital, that we may not have the appetite to undertake the kind of large-scale transformative investments we need to really get a handle on climate change. So I think you can read it both as a kind of encouraging story for climate activism, in the sense that so much more seems possible now than seemed possible just a few weeks ago, and the world is acting in an incredible spirit of solidarity for the time being. But it's also the case that this is already a kind of an unprecedented rapid challenge. And if we have to deal with another unprecedented challenge right afterward, it's not clear to me that we're going to sort of be answering that call.
Yeah, it's a very weird, this is obvious, it's a very weird time, but it's also very strange insofar as that, like, and maybe this is just a function of my job, but I'm always trying to sort of like, plant a flag in terms of assessing where we're at. But that seems to be very difficult to do, both in terms of like where we're at with the virus, but also like where we're at in terms of the way that we're all going to respond to this. Like, I was just thinking to myself as you're saying this, like, well, and frankly, I mean, I had written a decade ago, had pitched a show that was very much based upon my situation right now, but it was climate change 40 years in the future. And one of the things that one of the ideas behind that was this notion of like, you make certain mistakes, you don't get do-overs on some of the decisions you make in life. And yeah. We will never get back those 4 weeks in January or February where the government could have made had a much different response to what they did than they did, or, the decision 2 years ago to cut the pandemic response. And that would have changed things at least I think, like, to some degree, and, you know, how dramatic we don't know. And it's the same sort of idea with climate change, is that we just can't go back into some things you can fix and other things you simply cannot. But I'm feeling, you know, today in my life, I'm like, I'm no longer procrastinating. But in 6 months, if I'm in the same situation, I may be just like, I don't care what happens. You know, like, I'm not going to do anything. We have no idea.
There's so much that we don't understand about this crisis that we're living through. One of them is the sort of long-term effects on individuals. You know, what kind of political commitments we're willing to make 6 months from now, what kind of social and personal commitments we're willing to make, what will the psychological cost of living through all of this fear and anxiety be on all of us. We don't know that, but we also know we don't know some much more fundamental things about this disease itself. We don't know why it's the case that certain countries are doing so much better than others. To some degree, we can attribute that to responses. You know, in places like South Korea or Singapore, they've done mass testing in a much more aggressive way than we've been able to do in the U.S. But in Japan, they haven't. And Japan has a really elderly population, and they've been doing relatively well. In places, we don't know why, you know, Northern Italy is doing so much worse than Southern Italy. We don't know why it's the case that San Francisco and Los Angeles are doing so much better than New York and Boston. There's some theory that we may be dealing with multiple strains, some of which are more powerful and dangerous than others. There are also possible seasonality effects, climate effects that make it harder for the disease to spread in warmer weather. We don't know exactly the vectors of transmission. We don't know how safe it is to be outside together as opposed to inside together. But we also don't even know how the disease is acting within us when we're infected. You know, when it first arrived, we thought this was a quite conventional respiratory infection that was going to proceed much like SARS and MERS had over the past couple of decades. We thought we knew what we were dealing with. But the longer this goes on, the stranger the disease looks, even to the doctors treating it. So, you know, we were told that fevers were the telltale symptom. 70% of patients sick enough with COVID to show up in New York's largest hospital system are showing up without fever, 70% of them. Coughs are only showing up in about half of patients. That was another one of the kind of telltale signs. And we're seeing all of these other dramatic impacts. It's affecting eyesight. It's affecting brain function. It's affecting smell. It's affecting kidneys and liver, so much so that some hospitals have gone through shortages, not of the ventilators we thought we needed, but of the dialysis machines that we had no idea that we would need. And the ventilators, which we thought were going to be so critical in January and February, when everybody, including me, was yelling at the president to, you know, ramp up production of ventilators, turned out to be at best probably inconsequential and maybe by some measures damaging to the health of patients who would do much better on much less invasive forms of oxygen support. So 3 months ago, we thought the thing that was going to make or break the American response to this crisis was our ventilator supply. And now ventilators are totally irrelevant, and we're dealing with things like, why are so many patients' hearts failing? And we honestly don't know the answer to that still. So at every level of this, from the kind of the epidemiological level, how fast is it spread, under what conditions, et cetera, down to the public health level, what kinds of measures are helpful and which are not, and down to the level of the individual infected, there are still enormous questions, unanswered questions about this disease. And that's sort of natural, given that, you know, it's only 6 months since patient zero. But I think that people like you and me, who are sitting in the midst of the pandemic, looking around and trying to take stock of it, we have a reflex to try to assume that the state of knowledge today is like a good enough basis on which to make judgments about absolutely everything. And the truth is, the ground is shifting so much, I think it's probably not even safe to do that. So, you know, in January, the World Health Organization was telling us not to wear masks. Now everybody wants to wear masks. A few weeks ago, and even up until last week, we've seen large scale closings of beaches and parks and parts of the country. There's good science suggesting that basically transmission is impossible outside. And I don't want to say to your listeners, like, count on that information either. But it's just amazing how fast our understanding of this disease is moving and how little we can really know for sure going forward.
Yeah, that's what's, you know, really been, I think, sort of striking is that, you know, the all these things that we're you know, that you've ticked off. I mean, you know, ranging on, you know, how it impacts you and what are sort of the, like, even the broad stroke principles that you should be following in terms of protecting yourself. You know, I keep waiting for, was it Bill Pullman who was in Independence Day? I can't remember who it was, but, you know, just to get up and go like, look, we've dedicated $1 trillion to a think tank that's going to answer these questions by next Tuesday, and we're going to announce them. And it's going to be hard, but we're going to know, you know, we're going to have a North Star for all these questions. And we don't seem to know anything. Like, this is what you have a federal government for in many respects, isn't it? To sort of like assess all of these different like variations of how it's hitting around the country. Like, one of the things is we were talking about, you know, why does it hit in some countries and not others? And I know that your most recent piece was trying to sort of like anticipate, you know, it was talking about the models and the sort of the failures and the difficulties of modeling this. But it seems to me that we should, by now, at least, have some type of algorithm set up where we know what the
since it's a British term, they say R not.
R not. And we should know what the R not is in every state, right? And we should be able to plug that into an algorithm that says, here's the density in that state. Here's, you know, other demographic factors. And so we have a notion that, like, this state, it's highly communicable. In that state, it's not. And then measure it from that and see what, you know, so, but there's no, doesn't seem to be any type of, like, and maybe it's happening, we just don't hear about it because they are, you know, they're not obligated to come out and do a YouTube show every day and make a pronouncement. But I mean, is that going on?
Well, first of all, I would just say, like, the response of the federal government has been abominable, like, throughout this process. You know, at first, they dismissed it as a threat. They used it as a pretext for a travel ban that wasn't even effective in keeping people out of China because American citizens who had been in China were allowed to travel. They did nothing to ramp up production of ventilators when we thought they were necessary, or personal protective equipment, which we knew would be necessary, and which there's been a kind of catastrophic shortage because many of the recent infections have come within hospitals, passed around from healthcare workers because they're not protected in the way that they need to. And above all, they absolutely failed to organize or coordinate anything like a comprehensive testing regime, which would be necessary to slow the disease and also allow us to move around in the world with some degree of freedom. Even despite that, you know, the disease sort of being still out there, which it, I think it will be for quite a long time. On top of all that, there's been this really strange spate of stories where governors of a variety of states all across the country have been complaining that orders for medical equipment and PPE that they have placed and paid for have shown up and then been seized by FEMA to be sort of shoveled away to a federal stockpile, which is being dispersed according to, well, we don't really know exactly how that equipment and that PPE is being dispersed, but it seems to be part of an operation run by Jared Kushner, which is a sort of a parallel coronavirus task force operating entirely separately from the standard federal disease hierarchy. And at that level too, there's an enormous amount of confusion of who's in charge and who's making decisions. Is it more important when we hear Dr. Fauci say something on TV or Dr. Birx say something on TV? Or is it more important when we hear Jared Kushner saying something on TV? And this is, you know, this is just a total evacuation of federal leadership on the part of the president. And it's really striking to me, actually, as someone who's watched Trump over the last few years, I'm curious if you feel the same. You know, I've always worried, I think a lot of people on the left have worried, that Trump is such a would-be authoritarian that faced with an opportunity to seize authoritarian power and enabled by a government, you know, eager to give those kinds of powers to a president in, say, the case of wartime, that he would make himself into a kind of a dictator if he had the chance. This pandemic functionally offers him that opportunity. And instead, he's run in the opposite direction and signaled to the whole country that much more than his own desire to be an authoritarian is his wish to avoid all responsibility for anything.
Right.
He would rather like shuffle the responsibility off onto governors and mayors than even like, I mean, he could be operating a huge surveillance state right now. The Americans would basically buy into it. He has effectively, through the American public has, essentially shut themselves into little bunkers and is not going outside. This is a crazy, crazy political moment that we're living in. And Trump, rather than, approaching it as an authoritarian opportunity, just wants other people to have to shoulder the burden. For all of those reasons, I think the federal government's response has been catastrophic. And I think when you look at the shape of the curves in America versus almost all of our peer countries, it's horrifying. Just about everybody else has, they're still going to be living with this disease. There's still going to be infections and still deaths in all parts of Europe, in parts of Asia, in Australia, New Zealand. You can't beat this entirely because it's, the world has never been exposed to it before. But they've reduced the spread so dramatically that it is now responsible for them to talk about, quote unquote, reopening. In the U.S., we've flattened the curve, but we haven't reduced it at all. So we're now talking about opening up again and introducing many more opportunities for the disease to transfer from one person to another when we haven't even brought the caseload down meaningfully from what would have seemed a month or two ago a horrifying peak of deaths and new cases. But on top of all that, as awful as I think the American federal response has been, I also look around the world and think there's been a lot of disarray and confusion. Nobody's really known exactly what to do here. Different governments have responded in different ways. Almost none of them, with the possible exception of a couple of Asian nations who were keeping a really close eye on China at the beginning, almost no nation in the world got the response right at first. Even those that have done really well, typically had a kind of a terrifying spike followed by a proper aggressive response. And when you look at the international institutions and organizations that are theoretically designed to help us coordinate this kind of action, the UN and the WHO, they've been totally absent too. They haven't done nearly the kind of leadership and guidance that you would have hoped to see from them. Nor has the CDC in the U.S., which is meant to be a kind of an independent scientific body and world leader. And as to what explains that, I think it's an open question, which we're going to be adjudicating for the next few years. I think it's, when you look at the American side of it, it's easy to say that the Trump administration, following on decades of Republican pressure, has really emptied out the federal bureaucracy of a lot of its power and its personnel, and especially in those areas like disease control that are, staffed primarily by scientific experts who they regard with some kind of, cultural disdain. It's also possible that the failures of the WHO and the UN have something to do with the evacuation of American leadership in those areas too, that in cases like this in the past, the American president and the American government was really leading an international effort aided by those organizations, and those organizations are unable to really lead on their own. But it's still distressing that for a month or 6 weeks after the obvious outbreak of this disease in China, the WHO was still giving misleading information and advice about how to handle it. And the UN has done, still to this point, practically speaking, nothing to coordinate global response at a time when you'd want those kinds of institutions doing much, much more. So in the end, I think it may prove to be, a bigger failure than the American failure, a bigger failure than the failure of Donald Trump. He and the American government he leads may show us just how extreme our lack of responsibility and, ill-preparedness, how extreme that can get. But it's not, to me, of a category different than what happened in the UK,
right,
or what happened in France or what happened in Spain. And so on top of which, we don't really know. It's possible that those countries are affected by like a different strain, or that they there's something about their population that protects them that we don't yet appreciate. So we're still in this sort of early phase where everybody looks bad, even though the U.S. looks worse than everybody else.
There's a lot there I want to respond to. So forgive me if we sort of go backwards here a little bit, but and I imagine in terms of like, I am 4 or 5 years from now, 3 years from now, there's going to be at least some papers written about what happen to these organizations in the absence of U.S. leadership. I mean, I was just reading something the other day where it's like, the CDC used to be the first place that everyone would call across the world about this. And now they just realize like it's a black hole for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And, it may turn out that, some of the jingoistic rhetoric about America, leadership in the world in some areas would far more important than I think maybe some of us may have assumed.
On top of that, I think, I mentioned at the beginning that the way that this crisis has opened up some new political possibilities. One of them is really, I think people are realizing how vital the bureaucracy and institutions really are.
Of course.
Maybe considerably more appetite for restoring their strength and credibility rather than the last few decades when even Democratic administrations have been sort of playing a status quo game just to preserve the cuts that had been put into place by the previous Republican administration.
Right. I mean, the idea, one would hope, but I mean, I see no evidence of it in terms of Washington, D.C. right now. One would hope that this would spur a broader realization that like, hey, our job is to reinvest in the country, in the infrastructure, in the human and the physical infrastructure, and we should be in a constantly moving forward machine, regardless of the market for this, right? Like, the problem was that we just had no market for pandemics. Apparently, for long enough that it was sufficient to maintain our production facilities, if you will, in terms of providing responses. But I want to go back the supply line story, because I know you wrote about this. There seems to me to be two sort of like parallel stories here. One is that the federal government was using its air bridge to get supplies, to secure and procure supplies from around the world. They would bring them back and they would deliver them not to the states, but to like five or six medical distributors. I think McKesson was one of them. I think they do that with McKesson is one of those medical companies that also sort of is a middleman with drugs as well, I believe. And then these medical supply companies were able to sort of essentially open up an auction, and whoever had the most money got them, as opposed to sort of like based upon need and the government using the DPA to say, hey, you can take 4% off the top and that's it. And you need to sell them because we procured them for you to, these states and preferably in this order, let's say. And then there seems to be this other sort of parallel story, and I imagine at one point they might meet, of when the states decided to go out on their own and bring this stuff in, that the federal government was, like you say, confiscating them, and then they were going into this sort of Jared Kushner black hole. I mean, do you have any sense of like where these two stories meet? And the question that I have not seen reported out is, when we procured these PPE or whatever it was around the world, did taxpayers pay for that? And did McKesson and those types of places, did they have to pay the government back? Or was it just that we underwrote it and McKesson ended up like saying, okay, we got, double cost on this. We now pay the place you procured it on a 60-day, whatever, payoff timeline, and we make our money. Like, how did that work?
I think we don't yet know most of those details. We're in that stage of the horror movie where we're just seeing like the monster, like small parts of the monster. We haven't seen the whole ugly picture. I mean, we do know that everywhere in America, the cost of all of this stuff has skyrocketed because all of the states and all of the hospital systems are effectively bidding against each other, for equipment that is in short supply. In some cases, they're paying 10 or 20 times what they would have paid for, say, a surgical mask as recently as 3 months ago. And given that, you would want a federal intervention. You would want a kind of organized, an organized system to take control of this marketplace, and distribute the equipment to the places that needed it most, regardless of who had the money to pay for it. That is really the kind of response that you would not just hope for, you would sort of expect in a time of crisis like this. But what seems to be happening is, you know, almost the opposite, which is that the federal government is using its muscle to prevent any independent actor from going outside this system, and instead making sure that those auctions are the sort of the only source for any of this material. It's not totally clear to me what the motivation for that is. I think that Kushner has some just sort of generic business person sense that marketplaces are more efficient than top-down bureaucracies in distributing, you know, in figuring out where the best place to send stuff is. So there's a kind of an ideological component. But I also think that there's part of him and his worldview and Trump's worldview, too, that resents any independent operator from making plans on their own. So, you know, Trump really would prefer to have Andrew Cuomo kind of sycophantically thanking the federal government for their support and their help, rather than going outside of the federal system and buying the stuff on his own in the way that, you know, the governors of Massachusetts and Michigan and a few other places have.
But wouldn't that happen if the federal government was actually coordinating all this stuff and saying, like, here it is, we're going to... I mean, to me, it just sounds like the first part, where it's ideological, that is reinforced by everybody that surrounds that administration, the Heritage Foundation, whatever resources come in through Mike Pence and whatnot. And so the only thing they hear in there is that, like, it's almost as if, you know, like the scene where, you know, the gates are being stormed at the castle and all the best fighters just circle around the prince. And they're like, we're willing to give up the entire city as long as we keep the prince safe. And the idea is, like, that's the market. And there's the ideology. And then I think, like, the added thing from Trump and Kushner is just like, and while we protect the market, for, you know, ideological and also political, you know, reasons reinforced around us, we want a taste. Like, there's no way they don't have people close to them who are not profiting off of this. Like, I mean, I keep thinking about that Politico story of the former Republican fundraiser who, like, just 2 weeks after this hit, gave up political fundraising and sent a letter to everybody, says, like, I'm now in the medical supply business. And he's boasting about having 100 million, you know, access to 100 million masks. And the reporter asked him, like, how's that? And he goes, well, relationships. I mean, you don't develop those relationships in 2 weeks unless somebody has given you the apparatus. And nobody's going to just give you the apparatus unless they're getting a kickback.
Yeah, it's, I think we're very far from having a full picture of exactly how all this is unfolding and who's benefiting. But I basically share your perspective that the story that I think a lot about is the one about the guy who tweeted at Trump that he could supply, I think it was tens of millions of ventilators and got $69 million contract from New York State to supply them and hasn't supplied a single one. And he's not a ventilator manufacturer. So, you know, there are going to be examples of that kind of, you know, kickback economy, banana republic management, you know, throughout as we go forward and start investigating what happened in the past. I think probably some of that is inevitable when you're trying to move really quickly and are unprepared for a pandemic of this scale. But it's obviously the case that, like, if there was a pandemic response team, they would be able to manage it down somewhat. So there were fewer of those instances.
Right.
And if the people running the response as it exists actually had the well-being of the country at heart rather than the sort of short-term political interests of the president at heart, similarly, we'd be seeing a much better run show. And one of the tragedies of this is, you know, it's a small tragedy, but the former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, has been one of the most, I think he's been quite impressive, responsible. He's a conservative. He was the head of the FDA under Trump, so he, to a certain degree, is a Trumpist. But he is one of the most reliable voices on the state of the pandemic and what needs to be done out there. He's now a fellow at AEI. And he was forced out of the FDA because he had an opposition to, you know, he had sort of skepticism about
vaping.
And this is, for weird biographical reasons, a pet cause of Grover Norquist's. Grover Norquist is an avid vaping lobbyist, in addition to being, because of his position on taxation, a kind of a godfather of the modern GOP. And that, like, so it couldn't fly that the head of the FDA had a problem with vaping. And so Scott Gottlieb is out of the job. We haven't heard from the new head of the FDA during all this, but Gottlieb is like exactly the kind of person, if you had to deal with a Trump administration at all, that you'd want running the show. And he's unfortunately just writing from the sidelines.
I mean, I don't know how people and people should check out Gottlieb, because I agree with your assessment that he is a voice of reason in this. And he had actually an interesting piece in the Times about sort of what a new normal would look like in terms of living with this, which these are the type of voices that, you know, every time I've spoken to someone like an epidemiologist or whatnot, they're like, these are the kind of conversations we should be having at a national level. But that story that the guy is taken out because of vaping is, and incidentally, when it's been reported that when Alex Azar's called Trump in mid-January to talk about it after weeks of trying to get in touch with him about coronavirus, the only thing that Trump was concerned about was the vaping at that time. And, yeah. And I mean, it's just, that's just bat crap crazy. Excuse the, yeah. I guess the pun in terms of coronavirus. But so let's talk a little bit about the timeline and just to wrap this up. You wrote about how the models have been all over the place and, you know, how the perspective on these models have changed. Apparently the New York Times just came out with a piece saying that new projections from the CDC in documents obtained by the Times shows a steady rise in the number of cases and deaths from COVID-19 over the next several weeks, reaching about 3,000 daily deaths on June 1st and about 200,000 new cases each day by the end of the month. This has got to be a function of the relaxation that is happening my understanding is that right now, if you take New York out of the equation for a moment, that we're actually on a trajectory going up across the country. It's only New York that is showing, that is creating the sense that our rate of infection and death is going down, because so much of the first wave was all about New York. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, there's all these like models that are difficult to sort of capture, like how, you know, will that dude down the street be an a-hole and go out and not wear a mask because he's not worried about it. And like, we don't have a way of modeling that. The only thing we could really do is like sort of look and go like, okay, we're at 15-20% infection rate in New York. Almost 20,000 people have died. Times it by 60,000 people have to die in New York to get even close to herd immunity. But then, like, we don't know what happens if a bunch of people from, you know, I don't know, Georgia come up and, you know, go to Broadway and, you know, whatever. Like, how do we get a sense of what the timeline's going to be here? Because it really feels like we don't understand as a society that the virus has not changed. The only thing that we did was just make sure that we could measure, we could sort of somehow balance our medical capacity to deal with it in terms of just like sheer not our medical system falling apart. Nobody seems to like sort of get that.
Yeah, I mean, and that is a not insignificant achievement given where we started. You know, when we looked at in Lombardy in Italy, their hospital system was totally overwhelmed. We've managed to avoid that. My guess is that we will manage to avoid that forever in the US, and that's really good news. But when we started this lockdown, I think most people thought it was going to last like a couple weeks. But the truth is, you know, unless we have one of three, there are three things that could really bring about the end of this epidemic. The first is a vaccine. The absolute earliest it seems that that's likely is sometime in the fall. And most more sober assessments suggest that it could be more than a year away. We could have some kind of breakthrough treatment, which would make it, you know, a much less lethal, much less severe disease. But at the moment, we're only able to put into trial drugs that were developed to treat other diseases. And it's unlikely that any of those are sort of miracle cures. We've seen, you know, remdesivir, the FDA is now approving, even though there's really limited evidence that it helps in any meaningful way. It doesn't change the mortality rate. It may shorten the duration of the disease for people who would have recovered already. But this isn't a major breakthrough. And yet it's basically the most exciting, promising drug that we have. In order to develop a new drug that really deals with coronavirus itself, is going to take much, much, much longer than that. The third thing that could end the pandemic is, as you mentioned, herd immunity, which is like, you know, requires at least 60% and possibly 80% of the population to get this disease. And most even generous estimates of how many people have been infected to this point are only as high as like 5%. So we're very, 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 very far in America from getting to herd immunity. Now, it's possible that through a mass testing regime, especially with kind of combined with contact tracing, that we could live something more like normal lives without producing a kind of exponential growth of the disease like we had in March. That's possible, but we've done so little to prepare for that. We haven't used the 6 weeks that we've been in lockdown to build out that kind of system, which means that now that we're reopening basically in the same situation that we were when we closed down. Cases have nationally basically stabilized, but they've stabilized at a very high level. So 2,000 people a day are dying now, roughly. And if by June, the Trump administration expects that 3,000 people are dying a day, that is growth. But it's actually not that far from where we are today. It's just that we've sort of defined almost as normal this level of dying that a few months ago would have seemed absolutely horrifying to us. It does, you know, we're approaching 9/11 every day now. And that is absolutely horrific. The likelihood that this continues, I think, for a prolonged, protracted period of time is very, very high. I don't think that there's much chance, at least in the medium term, that we'll be able to reduce the number of cases or deaths at all dramatically. And maybe starting in the fall or so, we'll have some helpful treatments that make it considerably less scary as a disease. But I'm not sure that we can count on that, which means it may be the case that we're doing some amount of social distancing / you know, periodic lockdown for a period of a year or maybe even longer. There's a paper in Science suggesting it could run through 2022. So we're not just talking about dealing with this through the presidential election. We could be talking about this, dealing with this through the midterms. If we don't, you know, and there are things we can do to make that easier. And I also think the science is unclear just how much additional benefit we get from the true shelter in place lockdowns beyond what we get from social distancing and closing of large scale events and, you know, better hygiene. It may be that we get most of the benefit from doing those things and through kind of commonsensical, you know, how we interact with one another changes. And we don't need to like disappear into our apartments and our houses for 6 weeks at a time again. But the disease itself is going to be as scary, I think, in September as it is today, not less scary. And we have done very, very little to prepare for that outcome, despite now having, depending on how you count, you know, 5 months since the disease was really announced in China and almost 2 months since America as a whole has been basically sheltering in place. Theoretically, we could have done an enormous amount in that time, and we've practically speaking done nothing. So I think we're in for a long, long haul.
David Wallace Wells, we will put a link to your pieces in New York Magazine. Thank you for your time today. Appreciate it. Wish you had better news, but maybe next time.
Yeah, same here. Great to talk to you again.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Well, that's basically one half of the equation. The other half of the equation is what will our society, I mean, we've talked about like what our society is and is not and can and might do in terms of the medical reality. The other half of the equation is what will our society do in terms of its political response? And its political response in this instance is going to be implicate the well-being of people in a way that I think, you know, we just don't normally see. You know, right now we're still, I think, you know, we have now 7% of the population is taking basically some type of break from paying their mortgages. We don't have data yet on how many people are doing the same with rent. Mortgages, there is a forbearance program. We do not have that as it stands for rent. Although I guess arguably in New York, we have a freeze on evictions, but there doesn't seem to be a program in which, you know, in terms of the forbearance, you can take, I think, 3 or 4 months to not pay your mortgages. Double check on that before you not pay your mortgage, please. But you will have to pay that back, and it's unclear. I've heard competing things that people need to pay it back in just 1 month lump sum, or you will pay it back on some type of program. It's very confusing. But, you know, if I'm not making money in April, May, June, okay, I don't pay my mortgage, but let's say I even get my job back in July, no guarantee at all. Where am I going to get those 3 months? I wasn't making money during that time. It's not like I got rehired in July at twice the salary. That's not going to happen. We are, like, our government is not reckoning at all with what we're going to be facing as a society economically. They just simply are not. The Republicans don't care, and the Democrats at this point, as far as I can tell, have been feckless. They have put a couple of Band-Aids on this, but they don't realize there's a gaping wound that is just in another part of the body, I guess. We're just in this sort of state of shock. Seeing pieces now, like, progressives are not going to get what they want in this. It's just absurd. There does not seem to be a realization of what's going to hit. And I'm afraid that we're in another one of those situations where it's like, I don't know, maybe this is one of those situations where you can go backwards in time on some level because it's just going to cost you more money. But there is going to be a radical transformation of many aspects of our economic lives in the so-called market, in terms of healthcare. I mean, across the board, the question is just like, what is that transformation going to look like? And I'm just afraid that that Mitch McConnell is having a far greater say in it than anybody else. And that is not good. That's our free show for today, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed it. David Wallace Wells, he was not, maybe not as terrifying as he normally is, just because everybody's already in a mild state of panic anyways. I don't know, Brandon, where would you put that on the terrifying scale for Dave Wallace Wells?
I have a feeling he's enjoying being off the climate doom beat for just a period of time, however short that might be.
Right.
So I would put it at the lesser end of the
there you go.
Fear scale.
Almost hopeful. Not really. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. If you are suffering financial hardship, stress, and you want the membership, but don't have the cash, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will help you out. If you are someone who enjoys the show and are not dealing with any financial stress, now would be a great time to join. Your support makes this show possible. It's much appreciated. Also, check out the AM Quickie. And listen, if you were one of those people who used to watch the AM Quickie on YouTube, we've now moved it over to our other YouTube channel. It is youtube.com/majorityreportaudio. So check it out over there. It's same time every day. Check it out over there. Also, if you want to just listen to it in audio form, you can go to amquickie.com and sign up, or get it through Stitcher or iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. I finished my 5-pound bag of Majority Report blend. I replaced it with a 5-pound bag of Los Diosos. I am, of course, partial to the Majority Report blend, but when you're drinking now a full pot of coffee a day, sometimes it's good to switch it up. So I will do that for a couple of weeks and then go back to the Majority Report blend. Of course, you can make up your own mind as to what you will do at justcoffee.coop. Don't forget, tomorrow night, TMBS, youtube.com/TMBS, or excuse me, youtube.com/The Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS. Also, check out, Nomaki Kantz will be with us tomorrow. You can check out her show at patreon.com, The Nomaki Show. And on YouTube, The Nomaki Kantz Show. Jamie, are you there?
I just admitted her, so she should be with us momentarily.
Well, Matt, then why don't you tell us what's happening on... Literary Hangover this week.
Yeah, Literary Hangover, the twitch.tv/literary hangover channel have what was known as a stage 3 hype train, or maybe it's level 3 hype train, which is a real thing. My 10 first subs as I reached Twitch affiliate status. So we're really rolling there. I did 2 streams playing A Plague's Tale while talking about Daniel Defoe's Plague Journal. Folks, I want you to sub there at twitch.tv/literary hangover.
I didn't understand anything you just said, but but I imagine the kids do. Jamie?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes. What's happening on the Antifada this week?
I'm so glad you asked. This week on the Antifada, our current episode is part one of a 2-part series on the political economy of China, as well as the US, and how their economies developed separately and then together, and it's really good. So you should listen to it. I learned a lot from it myself. Also, coming out this week, we have an episode with the extremely smart Marxist, Assad Hader, wherein we do a little bit of Bernie postmortem, looking at it through the lens of depoliticization and how that operates in society. And, you know, we also talk about all kinds of other things, chiefly communism, because that is our favorite thing to talk about. Also, this Thursday, Andy and I will be moderating a panel as part of Red May Seattle, which is happening virtually this year, on coronavirus and the future of work with Aaron Bonanov, Annie McClanahan, and Magali Miranda. So I will definitely put that info in the blog. And I just noticed that my fun Zoom background that I used when I was having a Zoom party with my friends is still on. So I'm sorry if you have to look at the hallway from The Shining.
Great. see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 238.
56, 27, one half, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.